This is Audible.
Well-Behaved Women, Awakening. Written by Michael C. Bailey. Narrated by Darcy Cole. Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. The jailer opened the cell door and said, "It's time." He spoke without pity, without rancor, without any emotion whatsoever. She sat up slowly, her back seizing up from a long sleepless night on a cot that was little more than 3 wide planks covered by a thin woolen blanket. She mashed the heels of her palms into her eyes and let out a small groan.
"Tears won't help you now," the jailer said.
"I'm not..." She shook her head. It didn't matter. Let him think what he wanted. It didn't matter. She stood with a grunt, her bladder an unpleasant weight in the pit of her belly. Good. That would make things nice and messy. Appropriate, that. A messy death at the end of a messy life. The last time she tried to avoid the noose, she claimed to be quick with child. A fiction she sold by pissing herself at every opportunity. Her captors hadn't known any better. Most men believed the quim to be good for one thing only, their thing, and remained deliberately and blissfully ignorant of the rest. And she used that to her advantage. This time around, the governor, well versed on his infamous guest's colorful history, asked for a local midwife to offer an opinion. The midwife, a negress with a wide, round face and a better grasp of English than any of the jailers, came to her cell and poked and prodded and felt around for several minutes before declaring, firmly but dispassionately, that there was no child. Nevertheless, the governor ordered the execution to take place in secret, just in case the negress was wrong. It was controversy enough to hang a woman. Sending an innocent in her belly along for the drop had the potential to spark a riot. Officially, her death would be ascribed to a sudden violent fever that struck overnight, so if it was later learned she had indeed been heavy with child, God would take the blame. Well, why not? She already blamed him for everything. The jailer motioned with his lantern.
"Let's go."
She took her time ascending the gallows, and paused at the top to take in the sun lurking just below the horizon. The edge of the world was deep red, bloody. "And in the morning it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and lowering. O ye hypocrites, ye can discern the face of the sky, but can ye not discern the signs of the times?" From here she could make out the murmur of a restless ocean, as clearly as if she were standing on the shore, letting the chilly springtime water lap at her feet. She inhaled its unique bouquet, a salty tang with a sour undercurrent of low tide. A lone gull brayed its humorless laughter nearby. "Damned birds, always complaining about something." She smiled. She wanted to cry, but she wouldn't allow it. No, she wouldn't. She came into the world wailing, but damned if she would go out the same way. No, she would stay strong until the very end. She'd stay strong the way she learned. The way she was taught. The hangman was such a nondescript fellow. They often were. He could have as easily been a fishmonger or a moneylender. There was no perverse glee in his eyes, no savage grin upon his face. They almost never wore black hoods either, she'd learned, simply a look of bland disinterest. He was utterly businesslike in his work. He gently took her arm as he might when escorting a lady out of a carriage, and maneuvered her over the trap door. Dead center, so she wouldn't crack her skull on the way through. That wouldn't do. It needed to be a clean drop, and the rope had to be trimmed to the right length so she'd get to experience the agony of strangling to death. Too long a drop and it could snap her neck, granting her an undeserved merciful death, or even wrench her head clean off. She saw that happen once. The hangman offered her a hood. She refused. An old man with a painfully hunched posture approached her, taking care not to set foot on the trapdoor. A humble wooden cross hung around his neck, and he carried a small Bible that looked as old as he. He removed his spectacles, rubbed his eyes with the back of a withered hand, and suppressed a yawn.
"Am I boring you, father?"
she said. The jibe was flat and mirthless.
"I..."
he began, then dismissed whatever excuse he had in mind with a small shake of his head. He opened the Bible to a bookmarked page and read, but she wasn't listening. The gulls were waking up now. A flock of them rose into the sky, wheeling up over the false horizon of the city rooftops below, squawking their obnoxious, demanding squawks.
"Always complaining about something." "My child," the holy man said.
She snapped out of her stupor.
"I said, if you wish to offer your repentance..."
"I don't," she said. The priest stammered a moment, shook his head again, mumbled an "Amen," and closed his book. The old woman next to him, a nun by the look of her, crossed herself in silence. The jailer stepped forward, his eyes downcast.
"Have you anything you'd like to say before we carry out your sentence?"
he asked her feet.
"Not to you," she said.
The jailer nodded at the hangman. He slipped the noose over her head and cinched it tight, taking care to position the coil of 13 turns directly behind her left ear. The rope was new, coarse and harsh, and it prickled her unpleasantly. A layer of rust lining the irons around her wrists scraped at her flesh. The cotton shift she'd been wearing since her sentencing clung to her like a second skin of moss. The air turned sour, almost sulfurous. The stench of low tide in full force, and the cool morning air became bitterly cold. She closed her eyes. Anne appeared in her mind's eye, her face simultaneously hard and soft, beautiful, but fearsome. And all the terror she'd held at bay came crashing down upon her. Not over her imminent fate, but over what might come after. Hers had not been a virtuous life by any means, and never before had she pondered the consequences of that life once it reached its end. But now, with the hangman's noose around her slender throat, the trapdoor quivering beneath her bare feet, and the pull of a lever standing between her and eternity, the weight of her sins smothered her, crushed her, threatened to pull her down into a diabolical pit from which she would never escape. She wept then, and she bawled out an incoherent prayer that none of the witnesses to this moment could understand, a prayer to whatever god or god or gods might exist, that if she'd ever done anything to deserve a dram of mercy, let that be coin enough to buy her one more glimpse of her beloved Anne.
"May God have mercy on your soul," the priest said.
For a moment, she felt as if she were flying. 1. Rose jerked upright, a cry caught in her throat.
"Huh? What?" Calvin mumbled. "What's wrong?"
"Nothing." Rose fell back into her pillow and let out a shuddering breath. The knot in her chest remained tight. "Dream."
"Uh-huh."
"Same one."
"Uh-huh."
"Yeah." She willed herself to breathe the way her therapist taught her. Slow and easy. Breathe in, 3, 4. Breathe out, 3, 4. Breathe. Breathe.
"What time is it?"
Calvin asked. Rose opened her eyes. The room was dark. The alarm clock read 4:28 a.m. "Time to get up," she said.
"Uh-huh."
"Got to get ready for work," Rose said, suddenly wide awake. Calvin rolled over and hugged his pillow.
"Uh-huh. You've got to get ready for work."
"Calvin." Rose turned on her bedside light. Calvin cracked an eye. "I've got to get ready for work."
The other eye opened. His hand, warm and soft, found hers under the covers.
"Go shower," he said. "I'll get the coffee started."
Rose's fingers strayed to her belly, to the pale skin right below her navel. She jerked them away as if recoiling from a hot stovetop.
"Stop that."
The water was just shy of scalding. She bent over and leaned against the shower wall, using her forearm as a pillow, and let the rain pelt the small of her back. A knot of dull pain loosened slightly. Again, unconsciously, she ran her fingertips over the puckered scars, three of them, stitching across her flesh, left to right, not quite in the order in which they were inflicted. The first was directly under her navel, the last above the crest of her hip bone. The second, that was the one that really hurt, not just physically. The doctor said it wouldn't cause problems. There was a chance she'd experience menopause a little early, but as long as she had one healthy ovary, she'd be able to have children. She wouldn't need estrogen supplements. It wasn't a big deal.
"If you'd lost one of your balls, would you think it wasn't a big deal?" she'd asked him.
"Medically speaking, no," he'd said, though not as contritely as she would have liked.
She pulled her hand away and balled it up.
"Stop that." "I've got to get ready for work," Rose said.
"Check you out," Calvin said.
Rose smiled as a reflex. The uniform felt so foreign on her.
"Kitchen's a mess."
She picked up off the counter a bottle of Captain Morgan with one swig left in the bottom. The night before, it had started out full. Calvin took the bottle from her, pulled the cap off, and tossed it toward the sink. It bounced off the edge with a plink and rolled away under the refrigerator.
"I'll take care of it," he said.
"Cal, don't," Rose said in time to prevent him from spiking his coffee.
"Sorry, do you want some?"
"Jesus, Cal, it's 5 in the morning.
"Hair of the dog. Dad's never fail hangover cure."
She took the bottle from him.
"Not drinking so much. Rose's never-fail hangover avoidance technique."
"We were celebrating you going back to work."
Rose bit her tongue. Killing a whole bottle felt less celebratory and more like sorrow drowning.
"Coffee me, please," she said.
Calvin filled Rose's mug, the one with the smiling cartoon piggy on it, the one he bought her back when she graduated from the academy. She took a sip, bitter and hot. It hurt to swallow, just the way she liked it.
"Call me during lunch," Calvin requested.
"Absolutely, and when I get out for the day."
"Thanks."
"Hey,"
Rose smiled. For him, she smiled.
"I'll be okay. I have a whole department watching my back. They'll take care of me."
"I know," Calvin said, convincingly enough.
"It's okay to be scared for me," Rose said. "I'm scared too."
"But you're still going back."
"I want to," she said, an affirmation.
"I want you to," Calvin said, convincingly enough.
They drank their coffee in silence. Rose poured a second serving into a travel mug, put her hat on, and then stepped back for final inspection.
"Everything on straight?" she asked.
"Fit for duty," he declared without really looking.
"I'm done at 2. I'll come right home."
"Okay."
"I'll be fine."
"I know."
Calvin took Rose into his arms, held her, breathed her in, and then kissed her.
"I love you."
"I love you," Rose said. The flutter in her chest subsided.
"Have a good day, Sergeant."
2. No one in the bakery gave Rose a second glance. She recognized the plump woman with the obvious bleach job. Mandy? No, not Mandy. Her name was Mindy. Like Mork and Mindy, she'd tell customers, who were all honey and sweetie and darlin' to her. She used to regularly dote on how cute Sergeant Rosie was. "Too cute to be a cop. How does an adorable thing like you get to be a cop?" by working my ass off and refusing to gracefully accept you can't at face value. That's how. Mindy caught Rose's eye and gave her a perfunctory friendly smile, but didn't say hello, didn't call her Sergeant Rosie, didn't note how adorable she was. She was just another customer coming in at the ass crack of dawn to grab a breakfast for the road. Rose bought a blueberry muffin, a Desnuda Bakery and Cafe World famous jumbo muffin, dropped the change in the can marked Waitstaff Retirement Fund, no really, and returned to her car, where she ate her breakfast and drank her coffee and stared out the windshield in the general direction of the station, wondering and dreading what sort of welcome awaited her. Her colleagues, especially the ladies working in admin, were big fans of cheap Party City banners. That she could handle. The constant stream of gentle inquiries, how are you doing, you good to go, you need anything, asked with such care, as if the questions themselves might break her, not so much. I'm fine, I'm good to go, all I need is for you to stop asking me how I'm doing and if I'm good to go. The counselor said she was fine, she was good to go, and what she needed was to get back on the proverbial horse. That would be the only way to know for sure whether she'd fully recovered. Fully, with a big asterisk. Post-traumatic stress was a fickle bastard, Dr. Hollingworth said. It could sit and wait and not show its face for days, weeks, months, and then spring out and knock you flat, and over nothing. Dr. Hollingworth said she once treated a vet with 3 tours in the Middle East under his belt. He returned home with some IED shrapnel in his thigh. 3 of his friends returned home in flag-draped boxes. 7 weeks after rejoining the world, 7 uneventful weeks later, he lost his shit when a robin took a header into his kitchen window. 1 sudden bang was all it took. He curled into a ball underneath the little table in his wife's breakfast nook and screamed and wept for 2 solid hours. Rose put the uneaten half of her muffin back in its white paper bag and started the car. She drove past a cruiser sitting in the parking lot of the plaza with the trashy dollar store and the trashier supermarket stocked with nothing but factory second-quality merchandise. Cheerios, tomato ketchup, grayish ground beef, and jaundiced chicken breasts. How it stayed in business was a mystery for the ages. Rose waved at the cruiser. The silhouette behind the wheel either didn't notice or couldn't be bothered to respond in kind. It was a half hour before shift change, when apathy ran highest among the graveyard gang. A man would have to run naked down the street, unloading a shotgun into every storefront window he came across to get a third shifter's attention. Lazy dogs. Rose shook her head, banishing the thought. More coffee. That's what she needed. Liquid clarity. Artificial enthusiasm. No, what she needed was a single night without that weird damn dream. Every night. Every single night since it happened. Even when she didn't remember the dreams, she knew she'd had them. Whenever she flailed awake, gasping for breath, a phantom band of pain tight around her neck, she knew she'd had the dream. She remembered them more often than not lately. The last few weeks they'd been particularly vivid, to the point where she'd have to talk herself down upon waking, to assure herself that she'd left the dream world behind and returned to reality, and not the other way around. The apartment did not really stink of low tide. Those were finches and chickadees chirping outside her window, not seagulls. She was alive. She was alive and lying in her bed next to her boyfriend, and not dangling at the end of a hempen rope, piss and shit running down her leg. She was alive. The doctor said so. She was alive. Those 6 minutes aside. She was alive.
The massive concrete block that was the Worcester Police Department eased into view. Rose smiled. The building was still wonderfully, delightfully, comfortingly ugly as fuck. According to Eva in Dispatch, the department know-it-all, the architectural style was called brutalism. Brutalism embraced concrete and brick and steel, forming hard lines and hard corners, and modular elements to enhance the sense of practicality and portray the functional purposes of the interior space to outside viewers. Whatever the hell that meant. Brutalism was substance over style, function over form, distinction by virtue of being indistinct. Massachusetts had its flirtation with the style a generation or two ago, but it never took hold in any widespread manner, perhaps because such structures stood out like big gray sore thumbs in the land of wooden shingles and decorative shutters and gabled roofs. But they could be found here and there. Boston had its city hall and government center. Worcester had its police department. All of them ugly as fuck. Rose pulled into the employee lot, parked, locked her car out of habit, and leaned against the front fender, coffee in one hand and white paper bag in the other. She waited. She stood there, staring at the main entrance, waiting. The fickle bastard didn't show its face. Time to get back on the horse. Rose finished securing her belt and bounced on the balls of her feet, feeling the weight on her hips. She touched each piece of equipment, reminding her hands where everything lived. Gun, collapsible baton, OC spray, spare magazines, handcuff pouch, radio, taser. A lot of real estate on her belt, all of it occupied. She closed her locker. She had to slam it so the latch would catch. That hadn't changed. Nothing had. That surprised her for some reason. She expected things would have changed since last summer, at least a little. But the station had remained frozen in time, as if for her sake. The tile floors in the hallways were still hazy from wear and age, and stubbornly refused to come clean despite regular buffing. The locker room still had that oddly humid floral smell, like a bucket of potpourri indulging in a long hot shower. Nothing had changed. Everything was as she left it. It felt wrong. Lieutenant Owens leaned against the corner locker, thumbs hooked into a belt half as burdened as Rose's. "Sergeant," she said. Rose smiled. "Morning, LT." Owens nodded and returned the smile. "I'm trying not to ask how you're doing." "I appreciate that." "Yeah." She nodded again. "Would you think less of me if I hugged you?" "I would lose all respect for you." "Fuck respect." Owens had on Rose a good 6 inches and 30 pounds of muscle that had yet to soften with age. She hugged like a mama bear. "How are you?" "You said you weren't going to ask." "I said I was trying." "Doctor said I was okay." "I know what the doctor said, Rose. I read your psych eval myself. I'm asking you." "Guess I'll find out." "That's a fair answer." She put on her superior officer face, all business. "You better remember, though, there are people who depend on your head being completely in the game. If I think for 1 second you're going to fail them..." "I won't." Owens held up a finger, a call for silence. "If I think for 1 second you're going to fail them, I will be the first to tell the chief to take you off the streets, for their sake and for yours. Clear?"
"Yes, ma'am. Clear."
"Right then." The smile returned. "Time to go meet your adoring fans." Everyone on the morning shift was advised not to make a big deal of it, Owen said. Standing order was to treat the sergeant like everything was same old, same old. No hoopla, no special attention, no acting like she was a broken china doll that had been precariously glued back together. And for Christ's sake, don't make jokes. Have some fucking tact. Rose followed Owens into the ready room. All conversation stopped cold. Every face turned to stare in relief, in awe and admiration, in disbelief. Rose could tell who didn't expect her to return. Bastards probably had a pool going. "Go on," she sighed. "Get it out of your system." Bobby Atiff, no surprise,
led the applause, which instantly turned into a standing ovation.
Hans grasped Rose's in welcome, patted her on the back as she crab-walked through the crush of colleagues flagrantly ignoring the lieutenant's no-hoopla, no-special-attention edict.
"Take your seats, people. We're burning daylight," Owen said. Rose wound up sitting in the dead center of the room, her usual spot. She wondered if they'd left her seat untouched all this time, like a shrine or a memorial. The morning's rundown was as routine as it could have been. Car 55 was out with a blown transmission. Nancé was, quote-unquote, sick again. Several Newton Square residents woke up yesterday to find their cars had been broken into.
If the weather held, road work along Front Street would start up again, so traffic during peak hours would be a clusterfuck. Same old, same old.
"Booker, you'll be riding with Gerald this morning," Owen said. "I'm kidding, I wouldn't do that to you."
"Love you too, LT," Gerald said with a flat laugh that failed to mask his genuine indignation.
"You're with Aldwyn."
Aldwyn flashed Rose a thumbs up. She returned the gesture.
"Any questions? No? All right," Owen said. "Get out there. Do good."
Three.
"My wife is going cuckoo caca with stenciling," Aldwyn said. "Every spring she has some new home decorating obsession, and this year it's stenciling. She spends every free minute on a stepladder with these plastic stencils she picked up at Michael's or A.C. Moore or wherever, and this little sponge. She put this ivy pattern up in our dining room last week, right where the wall and the ceiling meet. Looks okay, I guess, but no point getting attached to it, you know? Next year she'll paint over it and it'll be something new. Am I boring you?"
"Yep," Rose said.
"Good. I wanted you to be relaxed your first day back. Figured long rambling stories of domesticity would do the job."
"I appreciate it."
Aldwyn nodded and hummed a nameless tune.
"You want to ask, don't you?" Rose said.
"Ask what?"
Aldwyn rolled to a stop at the red light, gave a cursory glance up and down the intersection, then eased around the corner.
"I don't want to ask anything."
"Uh-huh.
Rose, everyone and their fucking mom is going to ask you a million questions. You don't need me adding to the pile."
"But you do want to ask."
"Hell yeah, I want to," Aldwyn said. "Not going to."
"Thanks.
De nada."
Rose fidgeted. The newest cruisers and SUVs in the fleet had recesses in the seats designed to accommodate officers' bulky service belts. She had plenty of room. Nothing was digging into her back. Yet she couldn't get comfortable. Aldwyn tapped a staccato rhythm on the steering wheel and made a point of looking everywhere but at his partner.
"Did I tell you Joe Jr. will be starting kindergarten in the fall?"
"Uh-huh."
"Ah, never mind.
Let's see."
"I'll give you one."
"One what?"
"One question."
Aldwyn quirked an eyebrow.
"Really?"
"Yeah."
"You don't have to."
"No, I think I do. Otherwise I'll have to listen to your boring old man stories all morning."
"Well, fuck you too. Can I ask anything?"
Rose's fingers tightened on her armrest. It was going to be a big one. No one would squander their freebie on something mundane like, "How are you doing?"
"Yes," she said.
"What was it like?"
"What was what like?"
"You know."
"It sucked. It sucked a lot."
"No, not that. You know."
"Use your words, Joe. I'm going to make you say it."
"What was it like being dead?" Aldwyn blurted.
"I obviously didn't care much for it, seeing as I didn't stay that way."
"Oh, come on."
"What? What am I supposed to say?"
"I don't know. Give me details. Give me something. You can't tell me it's okay to ask you anything and then puss out on answering."
"I only said you could ask me anything. I never said I'd answer."
Aldwyn scowled.
"I don't know what to tell you. There was no tunnel of light, no glimpses of the afterlife. I didn't hear the voice of God. nothing happened.
Aw, what a ripoff.
For you or me?
You?
I mean, if you're going to go through something like that, you should get a cool story out of it. He winced.
I'm sorry. That was wicked insensitive.
Yep, kind of was.
Sorry.
It's okay. I said you could ask me anything.
She never said she'd tell him the truth. One traffic ticket to a driver who decided to blow by a school bus with its flashers on. Friendly warnings to two motorists with dead brake lights. Better get those fixed as soon as possible. One report filed on behalf of Mrs. Ann James, Endicott Street, who claimed someone, probably that Sterling boy who lives two houses down, was stealing her morning newspaper again.
Another exciting day in law enforcement, Aldwin said.
I'm not complaining, Rose said. I was ready to jump into the deep end, but I'll gladly settle for dipping my toe in the kiddie pool.
Enjoy it while it lasts. It never lasts.
It won't, now that you've said that.
Rose settled back in her seat and watched the city slide by her window. Although here, down around Broad Meadow, Worcester didn't look anything like a city. The more distinctly urban neighborhoods clustered together in Worcester's approximate geographic center. The surrounding territory was in places downright suburban, perfect for settling down and establishing roots.
She and Calvin talked on and off about buying a home. They agreed on wanting a quiet neighborhood, but that was where the consensus ended. He wanted one of those big houses like the ones along Highland Street, a mini mansion too large for their needs that required constant care and maintenance, which of course he planned to take care of personally. He so badly wanted to be a weekend handyman, always fixing or sprucing up something. She wanted something more reasonable for their needs and for their income. A modest one-bedroom somewhere away from the city, maybe over in Auburn, but she was flexible. She was willing to find a compromise if it meant they could finally end their time as apartment dwellers and become homeowners. They talked about it, just not recently. They used to talk about a lot of important things. Long-range plan things. Used to, just not recently. Eva in dispatch, Eva the know-it-all, snapped Rose out of her reverie. Report of a fight at Nico's, corner of Milbury and Ellsworth, she said, every word dutifully over-enunciated.
We're close, Aldwin said, almost apologetically.
Yeah, call it.
Right.
Aldwin hit the gas. The engine hummed with intent. Momentum pressed Rose into her seat.
It's nothing. It's two unemployed guys yelling at each other over sports.
It's nothing.
A bead of sweat slid down the side of her face. Aldwin pulled up to the curb and threw the cruiser in park.
You good to go?
I'm good, Rose said.
Rose, are you good to go?
Breathe. In. 3. 4.
Her heart fluttered. Her palms itched.
It's nothing. Breathe. Out. 3. 4.
I'm good, she said, affecting her cop voice. Low. Firm. Steady. They stepped out of the cruiser.
A ragged man in mismatching sweats, a light blue top and white pants sporting an old coffee stain down the left leg, took a drag on his cigarette, gesturing vaguely at the door to Nico's, and informed the officers with a wheezing laugh,
"You're gonna love this one."
Nico's was a typical neighborhood dive bar, the kind that held on to its interior gloom even at the cusp of noon on a spring day, the kind that refused to replace its barstool seats until they were more duct tape than vinyl. The daytime clientele consisted of locals with nothing better to do with their time than day drink and commiserate over whatever hardships they were currently enduring. At night, people from outside the neighborhood mingled with the regulars, slumming for fun and then hastening back to their cars because they'd forgotten how seedy the area was. Brawls weren't frequent, but they weren't infrequent either. In any event, they were usually over by the time any cops arrived, assuming they were called in to begin with. This one was over, decisively so. and the tall woman, dressed too nicely for the setting in dark skinny jeans and a loose-fitting white blouse, had clearly won. She glanced at Rose and Aldwyn as they entered, but did not remove the tip of her cane from her opponent's throat. It might have been the only thing holding him upright. Her left hand was frozen in a jaunty flourish, like a fencer preparing to cross blades.
"Ma'am," Rose said, cop voice in full effect, her gun hand, clammy and itchy, clenched and unclenched. "Step away from him." The woman smiled, gave Rose a small nod, and backed away, one foot gracefully crossing behind the other. She lowered the cane, slowly, as Rose ordered, and laid it on the floor, slowly, as Rose ordered. Aldwyn grabbed the man by the arm and guided him away to seat him at the bar. Rose caught a glimpse of a blackening eye and a trickle of blood running down his cheek. "Turn around. Hands behind your head. Interlace your fingers," Rose said. "Breathe. In. 3, 4. Her suspect complied, following each instruction to the letter. She didn't resist in the slightest as Rose put the cuffs on her and said, "You're not currently under arrest. I'm handcuffing you for my safety until we get this sorted out. Do you understand?"
"I understand," the woman said, adding with a wink, "My safe word is Aria."
Rose escorted her charge to a row of beaten chairs lined up near the pool table. They had to step over two halves of a broken pool cue. "Have a seat, ma'am."
"Officer, if you insist on calling me ma'am, I will have no choice but to file a complaint with your superiors," the woman said pleasantly.
Rose detected an accent. French, she guessed. But it was mild, the accent of someone too long away from her native soil. Time had sanded it down.
"On what grounds?" "Police brutality. Calling me ma'am at my age?"
"Do you have any ID on you, miss?" Rose asked, ignoring for the moment the sense of vague familiarity itching the back of her brain.
"In my wallet. Front right pocket."
The woman indicated with her head a long coat draped over one of the chairs. "And no, I am not carrying any weapons, and there is not anything in my pocket that will stick you." "How many times have you been arrested?"
"Recently?"
"We'll start there."
"A few times."
"In general?"
"Quite a few times."
The wallet, brown leather, old and beaten, contained a wad of cash, 2 credit cards, a bank debit card, and a Washington State driver's license. "Willa Belvoir, age 39. Rose had to look twice to be sure it was the same person as the one before her. Willa's hair was down in the photo. Here it was woven into a braided ponytail that hung to the middle of her back. But it was the same rich chestnut, and both photo Willa and real-life Willa had a small mole at the corner of her left eye. Rose called it into dispatch.
"Have we met before, Miss Belvoir?" she said. "I feel like we've met."
"Entirely possible. I am a well-traveled woman. And please, call me Julie."
Rose double-checked the license. "Willa Belvoir."
"How do you get Julie out of Willa?"
"It is a long story."
"How about we start with a different story, such as what happened here?"
"Well..."
Julie's eyes traveled from the stripes on Rose's shoulder to the name tag on her chest. "Sergeant Booker, I was sitting at the bar, minding my own business, enjoying a cocktail, when that gentleman engaged me in conversation," she said, nodding toward her so-called gentleman. "I invited him to play some billiards with me. I beat him. Repeatedly. That offended his delicate sensibilities. He called me a cheating cunt. I called him a limp-dicked pussy bitch." Her smile remained sweet and pleasant. "By any chance, did your little game involve any friendly wagers?" Rose asked.
"Gambling is illegal, Sergeant."
"That it is." Rose gave Julie time to continue, but she said nothing more on that topic.
"And then?"
"He took a swing at me. He missed. I defended myself."
"How did you defend yourself, exactly?"
"Anything I say can and will be used against me in a court of law, can it not?"
"You're not under arrest."
"Not currently."
The radio crackled. Rose stepped away, out of earshot, but not out of sight. No active warrants on Willa Belvoir, but several priors, Eva informed her. Mostly minor stuff. Multiple counts of disorderly conduct and public intoxication, capped by 2 counts of assault and battery.
Charges later dismissed, Julie said when Rose presented her with this information. Self-defense.
It's interesting that you need to defend yourself so often, Rose said.
Is it?
Rose glanced down at the cane. The shaft was glossy black, the handle a simple brass knob. Is that what the cane's for? Self-defense?
I suffered a rather serious injury a few years ago, Julie said, her good cheer flagging ever so slightly. Snapped my pelvis. It flares up sometimes.
Rose took stock of her suspect. Well-spoken, bright, intelligent eyes. Dressed as if meeting a friend for lunch at a nice restaurant. Far from home. Day-drinking. Pool-sharking. And brawling in a dive bar. If there was a thread to tie it all together into a neat package that made sense, she couldn't find it. Anything else you'd like to say, miss? The grin reasserted itself. The bar seemed to shed some of its gloom.
No, Sergeant.
You sure? Maybe you want to tell me what you're doing in Massachusetts. You're a long way from home, Rose said, waving the license. Did you move here recently?
Sergeant Booker, I would be delighted to tell you everything. Over drinks, perhaps? Not here, of course. I suspect I am no longer welcome at this particular establishment.
Safe bet. Wait here. She met with Aldwyn near the front door. What's his story?
Vic says he saw her at the bar, Aldwyn said, with a vague gesture in Julie's direction. Bought her a drink, chatted her up. She challenged him to some pool, she soaked him for $100 and refused to give him a rematch. Words were exchanged. I had to press him, but he admits he took a swing at her. She broke a cue stick across his face, smacked him around with her cane pretty good. Then we showed up.
Rose side-eyed Julie. So, self-defense?
Sounds like, yeah, Aldwyn said. Vic's not interested in pressing charges. Probably too embarrassed to admit he got whooped by a girl.
Ahem.
Sorry, too embarrassed to admit he got whooped by a woman. Ona's not interested in pressing charges either. He just wants them both out of here.
All right, you get your guy out. I'll let her go.
Cool. So much for a slow first day back, huh?
We were doing fine until you jinxed us.
Mea culpa.
What is the verdict, Sergeant?
Julie said upon Rose's return. Rose held up the key to the handcuffs. The Vic admitted he started the fight. He's not pressing charges, neither is the owner, but he wants you out. So I let you go, you leave quietly, and don't come back. Got it?
Merci.
Julie stood to have the cuffs removed. She threw on her coat, a navy blue trench coat that fell to her knees, and followed Rose outside. Stay out of trouble.
I make no promises. About that drink. Bridget's place on South Main?
No, thank you. Rose circled around the front of the cruiser. I'm good.
But we have so much in common, Sergeant.
Have a nice day, miss.
I can tell you about your dream.
Julie's last words didn't register until Rose was back in the cruiser, until Aldwyn pulled back into traffic, until Julie was a dot in the rearview mirror.
4.
She wanted to sleep. A short nap, that's all she was asking for. An hour or two before Calvin got home from work, so she wouldn't be too tired to spend some quality time with him. That's all. Instead, she spent the afternoon lying on the couch, wide awake, staring at a stripe of chalk-white spackle smeared across the beige ceiling. Calvin, the aspiring handyman's work, and replaying Julie's words in her head in a maddening loop.
I can tell you about your dream.
Such an out-of-left-field thing to say, like she knew, but she couldn't have known. No way. Then why did she say it? The moment was too random to be random, to quote her father. Devin Booker wasn't a religious man or even a spiritual man, but he wasn't one to casually dismiss happenstance. When you run back to your apartment because you forgot your phone and discover that you left a stove burner on, when you find a 20 on the floor of the supermarket, and then your order comes up exactly $20 more than you expected,
I can tell you about your dream.
Too random to be random. She started when the door opened, as if awakening from a light doze. She had no memory of falling asleep. The smile on Calvin's face. She could only describe it as relieved.
Hey, he said.
Hey, you. Rose yawned. Her eyelids felt leaden. How was your day? She asked as a matter of habit. Calvin had loosened his necktie, but hadn't removed his suit jacket. He'd had a hard day, but a good one.
It was okay. More importantly, how was your day? Good? Bad?
It was a good day, she decided.
Cool.
Calvin held up two paper bags. Celebratory Chinese takeout and wine. Very nice. But what if I'd had a bad day?
Got it covered.
He hid the bags behind his back, then re-presented them. Commiserative Chinese takeout and wine. Smart man, thought of everything.
Yes, I did.
Calvin plated the food and poured the wine, and insisted on hearing all about her day. He did an admirable job of sounding enthused about it. It was pretty routine. Nothing major happened, Rose said. Slow day.
That's good, Calvin said. Nothing wrong with a slow day.
Nope. I told you I'd be okay.
Hey now, don't ruin the moment by being an I told you so.
Doesn't ruin it for me.
Funny lady.
She hesitated. There was this one woman.
What did she do?
There was a fight down at Nico's this morning.
A morning bar fight? Man, they really start early in this town, don't they?
That they do. Anyway, this woman hustled one of the barflies. He got pissed, she kicked the crap out of him.
Really?
Uh-huh. Broke a pool cue over his head.
Damn. Did you have to take her down?
Oh, no. She was completely cooperative. Didn't give me a lick of trouble.
Calvin nodded. Good. Good. Is that it? Is that the story?
Yeah, that's it. It's just... I don't know. She was kind of weird.
Weird how?
Weird in that she knew about my dreams. I don't know. She was like... I don't know. Weird. Calvin frowned.
Your weirdo stories are usually a lot more entertaining.
I said it was a slow day.
Yeah, yeah, you did.
Rose set down her fork and took Calvin's hand. He offered her a wan smile.
You're glad you went back.
Yes, I am, Rose said.
Good, Calvin said, but the sentiment sounded empty.
It is good. I love my job. I'm happy to be back, and I want you to be happy for me. Calvin met her eyes briefly, then looked away again.
I'm trying to be.
I know. I'm really trying. I know. You've always been so supportive, and I appreciate that so much. And I know how much harder it is to be supportive when danger isn't an abstract concept anymore. I remember how terrified I was when Dad went back to work after he got clipped by a drunk driver. It was hard letting him go, but I had to, for his sake. He loved his job, and I couldn't take that away from him. Calvin nodded, took his hand away, and went back to eating his dinner. Half of their dinner ended up in the fridge as leftovers. The conversation, what there was of it, was gladly abandoned. Rose made it through the day. That was all that mattered. Clothes were shed hastily, left behind as a breadcrumb trail from the couch to the bedroom. Calvin kissed his way down Rose's body. His lips carefully avoided the scars. He eased between her legs, paused to wet his fingers in his mouth, and gently worked them inside her. She drew a sharp breath when she realized where his pinky was going.
Stop, she said. Not tonight.
Huh? I thought you liked that.
I'm not in the mood.
Calvin blinked once, slowly, his brow creased.
Thought you liked it.
I do, Rose said.
I don't mind it, she amended. Just not tonight.
Okay.
He pulled his fingers out and looked at her, waiting for instructions. He was tipsy. Tipsy meant suggestible. Go down on me?
Okay.
Tipsy also meant he was more enthusiastic about pleasuring her. He kissed, he teased, he probed. It was soft, gentle. Rose closed her eyes. It was a good orgasm. The 2 frantic minutes of grunting and thrusting that followed were a perfunctory quid pro quo at that point. She got hers, only fair to let Calvin get his. He fell asleep immediately afterwards, in marginally less time than it took to get himself off. But it was a good orgasm. Maybe too good. Her body was alive and electric, her mind clear and sharp and racing. I can tell you about the dreams. Rose glanced at the clock. It was almost 11. She got up, got dressed, and on her way out to her car she sent Calvin a text. Couldn't sleep, went for a walk, back soon. It was a shot in the dark. Julie never said when she would be there, or if, in light of Rose's rejection, she would be there at all. Waste of time either way. Rose pulled into the first empty spot along the curb she found, locked up her car, and crossed the street. Bridget strewed the college crowd, mostly kids from nearby Clark. The bartenders, well aware of this, were among the strictest in town. They carded everyone, sometimes before every single drink order, and they could spot a fake ID better than some of Rose's colleagues. They weren't shy about wrestling away a customer's keys when the need arose. Not that they overserved all that often, but it was a busy place, and canny co-eds knew to order from different bartenders on a rotating basis to maximize their alcohol intake. The bouncer, an African-American man whose barrel chest was level with Rose's head, asked for her ID. She opened her leather bomber jacket and showed him the badge clipped to her belt.
"There a problem, officer?"
he asked. "No, just meeting someone. Tall woman, walks with a cane. Have you seen her by any chance?" The bouncer laughed.
"Oh, yeah. Hard to miss."
Rose wove through the crowd, inching her way toward the small raised stage in the far corner. A backlit dry erase board near the stage listed the bar's rotating schedule of weekly events. Trivia night, beer pong night, quarter wings night. Typical college bar fare. Tonight was karaoke night, and Julie was the shining star of the evening. A one-woman choral group building toward the epic climax of Bohemian Rhapsody, her voice soaring and diving effortlessly. The spirit of Freddie Mercury was with her. She wasn't using the mic. She didn't need it. The final high note heralding the iconic headbanging guitar riff caused every piece of nearby glassware to vibrate. The entire bar joined in, singing as one, until the tune reached its melancholy piano outro, until Julie brought her bravura performance to a close.
Nothing really matters to me. Any way the wind blows.
The crowd erupted, its collective roar shaking the air. Bridget's new rock goddess spread her arms and tipped her head back and soaked in the adulation, and then bowed a deep, elegant bow, complete with a little flourish. "Sergeant," she said, stepping off the stage. There was a distinct wobble in her stride.
"Lovely to see you once again."
"I want to talk to you," Rose said.
"Let us find some place a little quieter, shall we?"
The bar had a back room, dim and relatively quiet. The cacophony of shouted conversation and blaring music from the main floor came through the walls as a muffled drone, as though filtered through a feather pillow. Julie chose an empty booth at random and plopped down. Rose sat and folded her hands atop the table, separating them. Drink, Julie offered. My treat. I'm good. Do you mind if I indulge? Judging by the glassiness of her eyes, she'd already indulged quite a bit. Julie flagged down a waitress and ordered a Jameson, neat. The waitress returned with the drink and asked if there would be anything else. I am good for now, thank you, Julie said. She watched her server leave with a look just shy of a leer. To new friendships, she said, raising her glass before draining half of it in a single gulp. We'll see. Neither of them spoke for a while. I don't know why I came here, Rose said. Julie took a restrained sip of her drink and said, I'm going to tell you something. It will sound crazy at first. You will think me a screaming lunatic. Absolutely, positively, stark raving mad. It will sound crazy. She leaned in. Right until the point when it starts making complete sense. Rose sat back, the Glock tucked in its belt holster, pressed into the base of her spine. Tell me a story, she said. Julie pushed her drink to the side and folded her hands on the table, mirroring Rose. Her expression turned serious. My name is Julie d'Aubigny. I was born in Paris in 1670. Uh-huh. So you're what, a time traveler? Rose said in the same gentle, neutral tone she used whenever faced with an incoherent drunk. Perhaps in a sense. You have a long way to go before this starts to sound not crazy. Not as long as you think. You see, I died at the age of 37. She held up a finger. Sorry, I meant to say I died for the first time at the age of 37, in 1707.
The first time?
I died the second time about 2 years ago. I was dead for a little more than 6 minutes. Rose's hands curled into fists. 6 minutes. When I came back was... Julie paused, her features screwed up in thought. Well, when I came back.
You're talking about reincarnation.
As good a word for it as any. I think of it as awakening to my true self. Although it took me a while to understand what had happened. I was for a long time very confused. I thought I was going insane.
Rose pressed her lips together, sealing in a torrent of snide retorts.
I had thoughts that were mine but were not mine. Memories of things I never experienced.
Julie leveled a hard stare at Rose and said,
I had dreams. I dreamt of my own death, my first death, just like the ones you are having, the ones you started having after you died.
Rose's old training partner, a lifer patrol officer named Artie Telos, was a hard-edged, self-described realist who somehow managed to avoid crossing into cynicism despite his many years on the street. A proverbial font of wisdom, he dispensed advice freely and endlessly. One of his earliest lessons, and one of the first lessons that really stuck, was a brief but memorable dissertation about self-control.
A cop can't afford to be anything but perfectly in control, of a situation, of a suspect, and especially of yourself. It's okay to be afraid as long as you don't show it. It's okay to be pissed off as long as you don't let it take charge. It's like that old deodorant ad on the TV. Never let him see you sweat. No matter how bad things get, you can never, never be the first one to blink.
Rose, as if unfazed, said,
No offense, miss, but you still sound crazy.
Do I?
What makes you think I've been through a similar experience?
You have, Julie declared. I can tell.
Is that so?
It is so. I have encountered a few others like us. I recognized them for what they were the moment I saw them, just as I recognized you for what you were. And you recognized me, did you not? Perhaps you could not put a name to my face, but you were certain you had seen me before, were you not?
never be the first one to blink. Come now, Sergeant. One thing I have learned about our kind is that we can sense each other. We share a profound experience. It is natural we would be able to recognize our own, even if we cannot quite put our fingers on what we are